The Tom Woods Show, episode 2117.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm delighted to be able to welcome my guests today. They're from the Chicago Thinker, a student publication at the University of Chicago. It's Mitchell Robson, and then somebody I told you about a week or two ago, Christopher Phillips. As a matter of fact, I played the audio of the question Chris posed to a panel on, if you can believe it, disinformation that was held at the University of Chicago not long ago. And his question was so brilliantly formulated, going through all the different cases, very, very high-profile cases, in which CNN basically took the regime line or destroyed a reputation or whatever, and the truth turned out to be the opposite of what they said. And then he asked, if this is just a matter of an innocent mistake, then why is all this bias in the same direction? Why are all these kinds of stories that CNN, you know, got wrong, supposedly, why do they all move in the same direction? You know, like, we don't see a lot of anti-Biden stories that turn out to be wrong. So what's actually going on here? And of course, Brian Stelter couldn't answer it. It was just so brilliantly done. I couldn't have improved on a single word of his question. So I have Chris and Mitch here because I thought to myself, if I saw the world as clearly as they did as undergraduates, how much better a position I would be in today, or how much quicker I would have gotten to where I am now. So let's throw some questions at these fine gentlemen. Wow, you guys went from being studious undergraduates to international sensations overnight. So first of all, Chris, I guess you were on with Tucker Carlson. This must have been insane for you guys.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty crazy. Like a dream come true for a young guy like myself. For years, even like at the high school level, I've been fighting for my conservative values. I grew up in Southern California, went to public school for a long time. So I was kind of isolated, I guess, ideologically, but just fighting for what I believed in. I never really lost hope. And it's just, like I said, a dream come true. It's been so great and so inspiring that I'm able to have an impact like this on such a level. You're totally right.
Well, you know, I did an episode about, I probably spent between 5 and 10 minutes talking about you guys. And I played the audio of you teeing up that question. And I said afterward, I can't improve on this at all. Not one word. I can't improve on this at all. And you're how old?
I just turned 19 a little while ago.
Okay, that's ridiculous, right? I mean, to be 19 years old, see the world that clearly. And of course, he refused to answer you, but you really, really lined up that question so beautifully when you concluded it with, how can we be expected to believe that when there's a consistent bias in a single direction, that that's just an accident? And that's one of the, you know, sometimes people say, do we think these people are wicked or just dumb? And I say, you know, if they were just dumb, they would occasionally fall ass backwards into the right opinion once in a while, just by accident. But yet they don't. They consistently are wrong. And that can't just, that would have to be an unbelievably unique form of stupidity. So I think we are dealing with something here that's that's rather sinister. Mitch, I'm sorry, I don't know everybody who did what. I know there was somebody who tripped up, who was it, Ann Applebaum?
Yes.
By asking about the Hunter Biden laptop. And her answer was, I don't find that interesting, as if that's a criterion for what should be reported.
Right. So that was Daniel, who was a editor with us on The Thinker. And, you know, our mission was really going into this conference and really with other things that we've done was just deciding to care because, as you said, Chris asked the question in an amazing way. He understands things really well. But at the same time, we know that at these and most of these elite institutions, of which many would consider UChicago to be one, we know that most of them would just go there and just fawn over these people. And, you know, Obama is currently at Stanford right now talking about disinformation and he's just getting the royalty treatment. So we decided, which we've decided with everything, yes, half the battle is putting things really eloquently, being intelligent about it. But half the battle is just deciding to care and saying, wait a minute, we have some of the biggest purveyors of disinformation in the entire world coming to a conference to lecture us in disinformation. We're not just going to stand by and listen to them drone on about it without asking critical questions.
Especially when at this point, I think a lot of people feel like whatever these people say, until proven otherwise, I'm going to assume the opposite is the truth. I mean, it's so bad at this point. And what they did to Nicholas Sandman, as Chris, you mentioned, they would have gotten away with if we hadn't had the internet. I guess the thing I want to know, given that you guys are so young, and I never thought I'd get to be, I'm 49. I never thought I'd get to be an age where I'd be talking to young people and saying, I'm so impressed with you young people. I sound old, just my brain having these thoughts. I sound old. But I want to know, what do you guys read? What sources do you read that you're able to become so well-informed? I'm curious about what a bright, plugged-in college student reads.
Well, Mitch is just a year older than me, so we kind of come from the same era. I think a lot of us in our age group, regardless of what age we are, we kind of all became politically aware around the same time, which was the 2016 election. I think that really drummed it up for a lot of us. So we were young people. I was in eighth grade at the time, and I didn't really know anything about politics prior to that from my environment. You know, pretty left-leaning place I grew up in. I suppose I would have picked the Democrats, but I didn't really know anything about it. So I started to sort of listen to like the radio and really take in what was going on and try to understand it, because I was always an inquisitive person. So I heard chronologically first came the DNC, and I thought, yeah, you know, that makes some sense. And then the RNC came afterward, and I really listened to that. And it's like, okay, yeah, no, that makes a lot more sense to me. I see that these fundamental values are, there's just a difference. And I agree more with the latter. So taking in all that sort of information, you know, as a young person, I think it really helped to sort of craft my mind and my understanding. I can say when I was pretty young, for most of my childhood, I was kind of overweight. And really after sort of taking in this conservative perspective, I began to take on this ideology of self-determination and self-responsibility. And I actually lost a lot of weight. So after seeing that sort of transpire in my life as a result of my ideological development, I knew that that was the way to go. I was just comfortable in understanding the world in the way that I did. And so I sort of cultivated that by listening to, as a lot of other people my age have, people like Ben Shapiro. You look at different various outlets. I read a lot of policy books these days. Mark Levin is a bright guy. Tucker Carlson's got some great books too. It's really about engrossing yourself in it at a young age, but more than just reading and writing, is getting out there and having discussions with people. So, you know, as a young person, as a high school freshman, I would get out there and I would talk to people who are on the opposite side. It wasn't hard to find them, right? So you go out there to a political demonstration and you really try and hash it out with people. And that sort of increases your resolve and makes you more articulate. And at the end of the day, that is kind of what you need in order to become this fully fledged thinker, in a sense. You know, we're the thinkers, but that's really where it came from, is just being young and engrossing myself in all of this content that was coming out at the time, such a pivotal point in our history. And I credit that and just sticking with it for being who I am today.
How interesting about you saying that you struggled with being overweight and that you conquered that. When I saw that video of you, I would never have suspected that. Would never have known about that part of your life. So congratulations. Well done. I'm sure you realize, though, when you sat through the two major party conventions, that there are plenty of people inside the Republican Party who are not really your friend, who are very happy to repeat this disinformation themselves. I'm looking in your direction, Mitt Romney.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I think on the point, I guess, of just what to read, I think, you know, looking at history and kind of how great thinkers of prior eras have analyzed the historical events of their time, I think influences a lot of how I read things. So, like, if you read, I mean, you can get wrapped up in kind of abstract theory, but if you read just some of, for me, I love Rothbard's essays just about very practical things about what's happening politically. I feel like at his time, I feel like that provides a good lens by which I can look at things now. So, you know, a lot of libertarians, especially, or respectable conservatives, you know, like the National Review types, Reason Magazine types, although they put out good scholarship, a lot of them are afraid to look at things through kind of a populist or kind of common man lens. And I think people like Rothbard were really unafraid to say, wait a minute, the kind of populist perspective, the common man perspective is one that's valuable. And so when I read things and kind of more broadly, when the thinker tries to reach out to people, talk to people, we always want to have respect for, you know, the people that are going to be overlooked. As you mentioned, people like Nick Sandman, who would have been overlooked if the internet didn't exist. But when we talk to people, we get all kinds of messages from just people that say maybe their daughter had an adverse vaccine reaction, or maybe it's a trucker from Canada that has messaged us and said that, you know, here he feels like what Trudeau is doing is really unfair. But the bottom line is we talk with very real, very authentic people who have lived experiences that, I'm sorry, you're just not going to hear from the likes of Anne Applebaum or Brian Stelter.
Can you guys tell me what you're majoring in?
Yeah, so I am thinking about econ, poli sci, and public policy. Might end up, you know, dropping one of those just because of all that has gone down. But sort of the intersection between economics and political theory and how we can sort of play that out in policy.
Okay, how about you, Mitch?
Yeah, so I'm doing physics and molecular engineering as a double major, and pursuing history as a minor, most likely.
So I have no idea how you even have time to be talking to me. Are you kidding me? That's insane. Okay. Well, Chris, all right, I'm going to have to write to you privately because you should go. I'll do my best to make it happen, but you should be at the Mises Institute's Mises University summer program for a week. It was the most important event in my intellectual formation when I was roughly your age. It was the most important. I mean, like, you think you're for the free market now. You wait, okay? So I strongly urge you to consider that, because you will find people there who are even better than Mark Levin and Ben Shapiro. Let's talk about, I want to tell you about something I said at a recent event that was held by the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, which is maybe an organization you guys know, been around since the 1950s. And the president of that organization is only 31 years old, gave this tremendous speech. It was life advice. And usually these are all just dumb platitudes that aren't actionable at all, like get up early in the morning or something. Okay, well, how's that going to help me? But I remember I added one to his list. I looked out at that group of students who were all about your age, and I said, one other thing I want you to know, just be sure to keep in mind, is that if you're going to be of this kind of frame of mind, go into it with your eyes open and understand that before you even meet certain people, you're going to be hated by them. You're going to be loathed in a way that I was not loathed when I was your age for holding the opinions that I did. Things have gotten vastly, vastly worse and more poisonous, and you're going to be very, very tempted at one point or another in your life to go to The Atlantic or go to Slate and write that article about how I used to be a conservative or I used to be a libertarian, but thank goodness I listened to so-and-so and now I see the world correctly. You're going to be so tempted to write that article and be clapped for by the Brian Stelters of the world. That's going to be so tempting. But just at that moment, remember that there's a ton of us out there who are backing you, who are invisible, but we're out there backing you. And don't do it.
Yeah, I got you 100%. Just being a young person, I guess, in SoCal, like I said, coming up in public school, I've definitely experienced that. The tide has certainly turned. I will say that particularly maybe in summer of 2020, we had the woke revolution. Summer of love is what they called it when we burned down all these buildings because America was racist, of course. That was a time in which, you know, if you didn't buy into it, if you didn't post all this stuff to your Instagram, you were a white supremacist, even if you weren't white. And that was a tough time. I mean, that is like extremely toxic. You know, you look at maybe the Red Scare back in the middle of the 20th century. And obviously, I don't agree with communism, but I come to University of Chicago, and this is a place where we value discourse, right? We value freedom to debate and discuss ideas. And it is just so fundamentally important, I think, that we don't ostracize people for what views they have, particularly if it's like within the Overton window, you know, particularly if these are views that are held by hundreds of millions of people in our country. And of course, you know, I can say these things, but at the end of the day, I've run into so many instances, even at our university, which I think is a great place. But there's people who will be wearing our hoodies of the Chicago Thinker. That's our, you know, our newspaper. And people glance at us. And one of our friends was wearing the hoodie and someone mouthed F you to him. I mean, that's like ridiculous. That's like, that's just toxic and it's anti-intellectual and it's disgraceful. So we're going to do what we can to foster debate and foster discussion. And if someone on the left wants to come up to us and tell us why we're wrong, we're so happy to hear them. But usually they don't want to do that. Instead, they just want to shame you and pretend like you're a bigoted, racist person. And it's just really tragic.
Well, Chris, you got tremendous coverage for just that question that you asked. And of course, a lot of it was very favorable. It was all our people cheering you and saying, this guy is great and all that. But I have to assume it wasn't all pleasant responses. And that wasn't exactly a small platform that on which your video appeared. I mean, it was all over Twitter and people were retweeting it like crazy. Did you have to deal with any headaches from that?
Yeah, you're right. It was, of course, enormous. Although I do have to say that the response we got was actually quite positive, you know, overall, at least compared to the low bar, which is what we're usually writing about, you know, when we don't have that platform. My question, a lot of people thought it was pure journalism, that it was fair and that it was an honest, inquisitive question. And I have to agree with them. I mean, I think even someone who's middle of the road can ask, why is it that CNN, you know, makes quote unquote mistakes, which I would argue they're definitely not mistakes. But if they are mistakes, like they claim, why is it that it's always to the left? And so how can that be? Like you talked about, right? That's just, I mean, it's obvious signs of bias. And so Brian didn't give a good answer. There was really no good answer for him to give. So he had to obfuscate and talk about irrelevant things, of course. But the truth is people have come up to me and they have told me, you know, I don't agree with what you say 90% of the time, but with this one in particular, I don't like, say, the corporate Democrats. That's what one person told Daniel and I really appreciate your guys' question because I don't like those corporate Democrats and the way they run things. So even if they're a leftist, they can sort of level with us and understand that we're going to ask a question. And that's part of the university setting. That's part of if you're going to have a panel at a school and have a Q&A, you got to be ready for that. Of course, people are sort of behind the scenes. I think we're kind of frustrated with what we were getting, but I think that's just sort of immaturity, maybe. They don't realize that they have to separate what we usually talk about and what they disagree with what has just transpired. So we got this attention. I think maybe some people might have been jealous or frustrated that they've been making fun of us for all these months. And now finally, you know, we're getting some recognition. It's sort of like a validation of what we've been doing this whole time, fighting for the right value. So, it definitely frustrated some people, but most of that is people have sent me screenshots of what their friends have said about us. And at the end of the day, big deal, right? Because I'll tell you right now, I've had a lot of people who have come to me and said, hey, my mom and dad saw you on their TV and they texted me a screenshot of it. And they said, please tell this kid he's awesome. And I value those people's opinions 10 times more than I value the opinion of some random person who is just going to hate on you. So we're going to keep doing what we're doing. But I do have to say that at least at this school, I think the response has been very positive.
Well, I'm under the impression that the University of Chicago has I know we're not talking about censorship and stuff and free speech, but it just reminded me, I'm pretty sure they've been open about having a fairly robust free speech policy. Am I right about that?
Yes. So they have the Chicago Principles, which is basically an articulation of free speech on campus. And that's something that other schools have kind of adopted as a model. I mean, I know Mitch Daniels at Purdue has, and they also have the Calvin Report, which is basically an articulation of the idea that the university in its official communications is supposed to remain politically neutral. And so one thing that we've been doing is trying to hold the university accountable to those standards because, well, there's really two things at play. Number one is what the administration's thoughts on free speech are is not the same as what the students are. And unfortunately, there are so many students on campus who just have no respect for free speech. I mean, we had someone on the Maroon, which is the other paper at UChicago, which espouses liberal views. We had someone on the Maroon basically write about the thinker saying that we should be censored because, God forbid, UChicago could be producing the next, wait for it, Ted Cruz or Josh Hawley. Ted Cruz, and a very scary. So we have tried to hold the university to that because students are much more hostile to free speech. And then the other thing is that we're worried that the administration, because there's been some significant turnover, you know, Robert Zimmer is stepping down, we're concerned that also the university doesn't care as much and that the university, if we don't hold them accountable, will take similar positions as students. And we have already seen this concerning trend manifest itself a couple of times. We've seen official departments put out statements on Black Lives Matter. We have seen the university install very recently a critical race and ethnic studies type department where they basically assume critical theory as a lens for race rather than, you know, questioning it, which is also a violation of the Calvin Report. And then most concerningly, they've made students in the COVID attestation, which you sign in order to go here, not only have they made students say, you know, I'll report if I get sick and I'll do this, and these are actions that I will do. They've also made students say, I acknowledge that if I am unvaccinated, I am posing a elevated threat to students and that I take responsibility for that. And the thing is, that's a political statement. I don't agree with that premise, but that is a contested statement. And that's forcing students to agree with something ideologically, which is never something the university is supposed to do. So these are all concerning trends that we are trying to say, hey, this is a violation of the Calvin Report. This is a violation of the Chicago principles. Please remain what you once were.
How would you describe the Chicago Thinker to somebody?
Well, we are the University of Chicago's premier publication. Take that to the bank. You know, we're doing great things. You know, we're reporting on campus craziness through a conservative and libertarian lens like no one else is doing. So what we do is our number one criterion for membership of our publication is not your political views. It is not your writing ability. We have a lot of people who have just started writing. We have a lot of people who actually, you know, we have a guy who's a registered Democrat, but particularly on the COVID policies, he doesn't agree with the mainstream narrative. So we have a lot of ideological diversity in our paper. The number one criterion is bravery. You have to be brave to speak your mind and not be afraid to be pressured by the mob to be quiet. Our motto is outthink the mob. So what we push for is even maybe over conservative principles, just freedom to debate your ideas without fear of persecution. We have stuck to that. We have faced a lot of scrutiny, of course, at our university, but it's the support of the people from the outside world who kind of see what we're doing and see what is going on at these universities, and particularly our own, as a result of our reporting. And they say, wow, that's insane. That's crazy what's going on there. So there's all kinds of stuff that's always happening, as you might imagine, at the University of Chicago. So we report on these sorts of things through a lens that mirrors our own values. And a lot of people from outside the university pick up on it. And it's really a tool to inform people, because a lot of the stuff that is happening at higher institutions of higher education sort of seems behind the scenes. How would the common man get access to this stuff? But what we do is we are living it. And so we take it and we send it out. And you'll see our articles so commonly. It's some outrageous thing that the university is doing, or even at the city of Chicago. And we crank it out, and then people from the outside world can sort of read what's going on. So we don't publish any pieces with pen names. We have to put our name on everything, because what we're going to do is take responsibility for what we say. We're going to be bigger than the other side. And what we're going to do is stand up to the idea of censorship. And we're going to speak our mind, and people are going to get mad at us. But that's just a natural result of having a political discussion, because what's happening right now is censorship, which really all sides should be against. You know, the left was against political censorship in the 60s in Berkeley, let's say. It was the other way around. And now that they basically own the institutions, it's like, well, you know, actually, maybe you shouldn't be saying those things. We're going to shut you up. So in the broad scheme of things.
But see, that makes me wonder, were they sincere in those days? Or were they really basically saying, despite what they may have said publicly, in their minds, were they making a mental reservation and saying, really, what we want is to be able to say what we want? What we're standing up for is the right to say what we want. We're not actually standing up for some abstract right for anybody to say what he wants. I wonder, because they are such hypocrites, I wonder if maybe all this time they were insincere. I guess we can't know.
I think it might be that they were insincere. I mean, one thing that we've tried to emphasize more implicitly in terms of what we cover, I mean, yes, we cover some national topics, and obviously something we covered on campus did, i.e., you know, the disinformation conference did become part of the national conversation, but we try to emphasize that we're a college publication. And what we found is that people care on the national level. People care about college news if it's covered in the right way. And you might ask, why do they care? And it's because people, I think, view elite universities as a proxy for what's coming next. So a few decades ago, you had, you know, a lot of people saying, oh, I'm really concerned about some of the ideas in academia floating around, and kind of the typical, you know, left-wing response would be, oh, they're just ivory tower elites that are just kind of having fun in their own world, and it's never going to move on to culture, move on to politics. And it's like, okay, well, now we have our president saying Latinx. So clearly what's happening in academia at any given point in time becomes the political and cultural reality 10, 20 years later. And, you know, some of our peers are going to, without a doubt, be influencing the national conversation someday. And so we want to say, hey, look, this is what's happening right now. And I think people see that and say, oh gosh, what's happening at UChicago right now could be what's happening in the United States of America in 15 years.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, BitTrust IRA. A lot of people have been putting crypto into their IRAs. And if you're thinking of doing the same thing, adding Bitcoin to your retirement account, the best way is through BitTrust IRA. The crypto world can be confusing. It's hard to know where to get started. These guys will help you. BitTrust IRA stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. And by the way, when they say nuclear bunkers, that isn't just hyperbole where they're saying it's really, really secure. We're actually talking about decommissioned nuclear bunkers. They have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. So how do you get started? Go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners. That's a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods. bittrustira.com/woods. You told me, Mitch, that you guys attended an event on campus recently featuring Leanna Wen.
Yes.
Can you tell me how that went? And first of all, do you want to, either you or I can set the stage and make sure everybody knows who that is.
Yeah, I mean, Leanna Wen is CNN's, you know, one of basically their consultants that they ask for medical advice. Basically, she's been their chief kind of COVID person. And so she has actually gotten a lot of flack lately from both sides because she was advocating for, at the beginning of the pandemic, she was advocating for the most intense measures, mask mandates, vaccine mandates. And so
vaccine mandates for interstate travel.
For interstate travel. So she said that the unvaccinated should not be allowed within the public sphere. And yet now she's saying that we should open things up. And the forever masker liberals are actually correct about criticizing her and saying that she's being very inconsistent because, you know, back she was saying cases and deaths are so bad right now that we have to lock down. But then on the very day that cases and deaths were a lot worse than when she said we needed to lock down, she said that we need to open up. And so it's clearly motivated by political expediency because people are getting, even the most originally adherent people are getting tired of these mandates. And so she's kind of acknowledging that political reality. And that's why I was so alarmed at her talk yesterday. So much of it, she said to us, she said, we need to realize that public health comes at the intersection of both science and political reality. And that, you know, if people are tired of things, that needs to be part of the calculus. And she talked about how originally she was locking down and then her own risk calculus flipped with Omicron. And I'm thinking to myself, well, why was I an evil serial killer of grandmothers when my risk calculus was like that a few months before? But now you can say, she said the words, my risk calculus changed. And it's, I'm thinking to myself, well, so you're saying the entire country needs to operate on your risk calculus and no one else. That requires to me a severe amount of arrogance. And so we questioned her on that. Two of us, Daniel and Jonathan, asked her questions. So that was very interesting to see.
Well, how did you challenge her on this? Because it is interesting that she's getting such pushback from the hysterical people. But as you say, in a sense, they have a point that nothing has really changed that would justify her change other than her own subjective sense of what's risky or not. But the numbers, they might say, well, we have these numbers then, you were upset, now we have them now, and you want life to go back to normal. It's discouraging to see how many people want to stick to restrictions forever. Mm-hmm. But it's just interesting to observe the phenomenon of this woman. So, and by the way, when you go to an event like this, do you guys sit around and plan out, now, wait a minute, what is the best, toughest, most weasel-proof question I can ask? Or how do you do it?
So yeah, we definitely plan ahead of time, but there's obviously some adaptability. So if she says something that in real time we know is ridiculous, we're going to kind of, call an audible and change our strategy. But so there's definitely planning that goes into it. And we'll say, oh, this person's coming to campus. We need to do this. And so what happened yesterday was we asked two questions. So Jonathan asked about her support of mask mandates until she said on the news suddenly that cloth masks are nothing more than facial ornaments. And Daniel asked about her statement about placing the unvaccinated essentially under house arrest, basically saying that they can't go in public. And so what she said about Jonathan's question about masks, where she was in favor of mask mandates, and then suddenly she said that, you know, they are actually cloth masks or just facial ornaments. She basically said, leading up to her saying that, basically she said, we had good information because kids in schools who are wearing masks versus not wearing masks, there weren't outbreaks. And so we based our policy for the entire country off of this one handful of studies about kids in school. But then I realized with Omicron that they don't really seem to be reducing cases. So I had to change my tune. And it was that Omicron that made me realize. And so once again, I'm saying to myself, similar with her whole risk calculus thing, well, if Omicron was what required you to realize that cloth masks are silly and don't really work for the purposes of spreading a disease like COVID, fine. But why, when I realized it before you did, through the scientific literature I read, through amazing people who are doing great research like Ian Miller, Kevin McKernan, et cetera, you know, I've talked to these people and I've read what they do, and I see that masks, cloth masks, have never really worked to stop COVID in any material way. Was I, you know, an evil fascist then, you know, just because I realized things sooner than you did? So, and then with Daniel's question about placing the unvaccinated, making them unable to, you know, engage in interstate travel, go in public spaces, she did, you know, really trivialize it. And what's just so concerning to me is that she can so cavalierly say that, you know, an entire segment of tens of millions of people, I think at the time she said it was 150 million, I'm not sure now how many are unvaccinated in the US, that you can basically just revoke any of their all of their freedom because they refuse to get a product from Big Pharma.
All right, well, that's really good stuff. So now you guys are not just a publication, but you're like the people who, when they have these public events, they have to wonder, what are those meddling kids going to do at our event this time?
Oh, yeah. You know,
and good. Keep them off balance, right?
Sure, yeah. You know, what we're doing, we really are the countercultural people. You may have seen, you know, my hair, for instance, is not super generic. And when I first got this hairstyle a number of years ago, my mom said, Chris, you're like the conservatives. You know, that hair doesn't really match them. I said, Mom, we are the countercultural people now. We are the ones that are fighting back against the machine, right? We are the resistors. So, you know, when you have your ideology and you say that you're fighting the power, and then Starbucks takes days off to mandate this training to its employees of white fragility or whatever it is, you're not fighting the power. You are the power, or at least you're playing into it. So we really don't have so much resources to do this. We have the IOP, that is supposedly a nonpartisan institute. And they
is that Institute of Politics,
yes,
IOP?
That's correct. The Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, founded by David Axelrod a number of years ago, chief Obama guy. He has brought in a lot of different people. He's, you know, to his credit, it's not all Democrats, but when it's a conservative, it's a token conservative, right? It's a faker. It's Jonah Goldberg. It's Bill Kristol. These kinds of people who don't actually believe in the movement, right? Who have sold their souls to the other side. So this is totally a partisan institute, of course, in practice. We all know this. So we come in and, of course, they have to protect the integrity of it by saying, well, we're going to let everyone ask a question. And there are ways to dismantle this propaganda operation. And so we just, you know, we're a bunch of kids. We stand up to this by going in and asking a question, and they fold. They fold so quickly, and it explodes over the media because all it takes is just a little bit to come in and ask a question. And, you know, we didn't have some calculated thing. We didn't shout them down like they do at other universities, right? The left-leaning students will shout down the speakers that they disagree with. we went and we heard them out and then we engaged with them, right? That's what we do here. So then these people, their propaganda campaigns are demolished almost instantly. And it really brings a lot of attention to it because it just goes to show that all you need is a little initiative to fight for what you believe in and it can have huge results. So that's why we're really proud to be doing what we're doing. We're getting a lot of coverage, but it's not just necessarily about that. It's more about just fighting for what we believe in and having the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, and I mean, it just shows what you were saying, just shows that these people like Brian Stelter and Ann Applebaum are so insulated from criticism that they don't even know how to engage with the most simple of questions. So like Chris and Daniel's questions were very good, but they were still, you know, quite simple. They were asking, it was a very simple premise and a very simple question, and both just completely folded. And the reason is because somehow, you know, in the case of say Ann Applebaum, a Pulitzer winning author, you know, someone who frequently writes for one of the nation's most well-known publications, somehow she has received less criticism in her, some would say, illustrious career, and same with Brian Stelter, than someone like Chris or myself or someone else on the Thinker College students than one of us receives in a day. And so we have just exposed the fact that they are unable to answer these questions. And it's because they are so insulated from criticism. They live within this bubble. And they were obviously completely unprepared. And it was because they thought this would just be a, you know, a worship fest, that this conference, essentially. You guys know what the truth is. We love you. We won't question you. And disinformation is whatever you guys say is disinformation.
Do you guys have an online version of your publication? I assume you would.
Yeah, so that is the main outlet of where we have our stuff. It's on thechicagothinker.com. So that is where all our stories are found. You really ought to check us out. Obviously, that's, you know, the main place where we get our stuff out to people. We're also on Twitter and Instagram, Twitter at ThinkerChicago and Instagram at TheChicagoThinker. So we put stuff out all the time, and it's really a great way to follow us on you know, the socials, and also sign up for our newsletter through email on our website. Again, thechicagothinker.com. That's a great way to stay engaged with it without having to check it every single day or whatever. We put out a newsletter every so often about just the biggest stories that we've published in the past couple of weeks. And that is where anyone listening can find all of the instances of this crazy stuff that's going on and what we're going to do about it.
You know, this again goes to show my age. When I worked for a campus publication, not unlike the Chicago Thinker, this was, you know, I'm sorry to say, it was basically before the internet. So we had a print publication. Yeah. But the fun of a print publication was that I was a Harvard undergrad, and now for years they've randomized where the students live in their upper class years. But in my day, there was a certain character to each of the upper class houses. So one would be the snob house, like the super elite, and one would be the athlete house, and one was the artsy house. And the artsy house was the one where the people most disliked our publication. So we were so childish. Every time we'd come up with a new issue, we would absolutely saturate that building with copies of it everywhere. Absolutely everywhere. Just for, you know, it would be, you know, all over the dining hall. It would be like in the flower pots. It would be everywhere to let them know you're not going to scare us. Now, sure, we did that in the dark of night because we were scared of these people, but at least it was to give the impression that we were fearless.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, we, you know, it's not to sound arrogant or anything, but we almost like don't have time for our biggest kind of coordinated group against us on campus would be the other publication, The Maroon, which has been around for so long, whereas we've only been around for, you know, not even 2 years. And they write hit piece after hit piece about us. I already mentioned the one about saying that, you know, you Chicago, if it doesn't censor, that they'd be fostering the next Ted Cruz. But we've had many hit pieces about us. And we've honestly realized that we just don't really have time for them. And it kind of, you know, we have bigger and better things to be concerned about. The administration's doing a lot of things wrong. When you know, the Maroon, maybe we'll write a piece or two, but we really let them. You know, I mean, I kind of think of that picture of, I don't know if either of you have ever seen it, but it's that picture where Michael Phelps is looking towards the finish line and his opponent is looking at him and they're just focused on us, whereas we're focused on our goals. But sure, when the Maroon does something really outrageous, we'll definitely post about it. And we're not this isn't a Maroon-sponsored thing, but much of the Maroon is getting on board with a petition to reinstate the campus mask mandate that was lifted a few weeks ago. Real rejectors of the establishment, but
yeah.
So we've had many members of the Thinker have kind of said this is a, just on their social medias, this is a ridiculous petition. So we definitely kind of fight the campus version of culture wars a little bit without letting it preoccupy too much of our energy. And we're kind of, as Chris was saying, you know, with his haircut and all that, we're trying to make conservatism, libertarianism cool. And that's definitely reflected in the support, you know, we have from a lot of these conventionally considered cool groups on campus, like the football team are avid readers of us. One of the fraternities on campus are avid readers of us. So it's been nice to make conservatism kind of cool on campus, even if the loud people want to pretend like it's not.
And to add on to that, you know, it's it is a different day. And maybe back then there was a certain group of people that didn't like the conservative voice, but now it's like a lot of people, even at the great University of Chicago, we're not immune to sort of a suffocating culture, right? We call it the mob. And it's really everyone that is, you know, you have to be vigilant, right? So we do what we can, you know, we like you, Tom, we do a little trolling, you know, at times to sort of tease these people. But at the end of the day, you got to, like Mitch said, you got to face forward and do what you think is right always. And sometimes people are going to congratulate you. We have come to realize that most of the time people are going to criticize you at a place like this. But that is not hampering our ability to fight for the truth always, because fighting for the truth and trying to figure out what's right is infinitely more fulfilling to us than fitting in ever could be.
Well, congratulations to the both of you for being courageous, having independent minds, for doing what you're doing. I'll recommend that people check out thechicagothinker.com. I'm going to link to that and also the Twitter accounts for the two of you also on the show notes page. All this stuff will be up at tomwoods.com/2117. Thank you guys very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having us.
All right, that's going to do it for today. Tomorrow, the great Robert Barnes joins us. If you don't know who Robert Barnes is, look him up and you're going to say, this is going to be a great conversation. Oh, I promise you it will be. So make sure you subscribe to the Tom Woods Show, tomwoods.com/Apple. Lots of ways you can listen to the Tom Woods Show, but make sure you do it because you're not going to want to miss episode 2118. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.